This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Not every librarian has her own Wikipedia page, let alone one with actual subcategories. But Jessamine West is probably not your typical librarian. Or maybe she's just the ur-librarian, and she's just better known than many others in her profession who keep a lower profile. But it shouldn't be surprising that her online presence is robust. She created Librarian.net, one of the earliest and most influential librarian blogs in the early days of blogging in general. She works for the Open Library Project, which allows people to borrow free ebooks. The blog Boing Boing has called her an internet folk hero. And yesterday, she was awarded the Vermont Library Association's Library Advocate of the Year Award, in part because of her work in getting a new nominee to be the Librarian of Congress. Jessamine West lives in Randolph, and she joins us now. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a librarian without a library, in the sense that you don't have a bricks-and-mortar library that you work at 40 hours a week. So what do you do?
Well, like you said, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to be a librarian. Sometimes you work in a library and maybe you do or do not have a library degree. Sometimes you have a library degree and you do information professional work, not within a building. For me, I have a combination of jobs like many people in Vermont. I work for the Internet Archives Open Library Project. I work at the Randolph Technical Career Center a couple hours a week doing computer drop-in time and adult education classes. Got a computer question. I'm the computer lady. I do some writing for Computers in Libraries magazine, which is an adorably named magazine, talking about technology topics. And I do some public speaking, going to library conferences and talking about topics like the digital divide or social media for libraries, that kind of thing.
How does one become a celebrity librarian? I mean, you certainly are.
You know, the job itself, I like to think about it like many professions have sort of people that talk about the profession and people that do the work. And librarianship, obviously, I believe needs both sort of more than ever. I think one of the reasons we had a long-standing image problem was because we just kind of did our work and didn't matter what people said about us. We knew we were good and doing good works. But as, you know, media gets more 24/7, as social media becomes more of how people know about things, we've had to have a response to that. And as somebody who's tech friendly and library friendly, it just seemed like an unfilled niche to go chit-chatting about, hey, libraries are actually kind of terrific. And the more you talk about that, people pick that up, especially using technology like social media. And people know you sort of despite yourself, kind of. And also because I don't work 40 hours a week, I have time to bang the drum, so to speak, and tell the stories of the people who are working 40 hours a week who don't have that time.
Well, then tell part of the story about why libraries are so important and so relevant. Because, you know, one of the things that we hear is that it's the digital age. You can get access to information anywhere on your phone. You don't need a library. You don't need a librarian in the way that you might have a generation or two generations ago. But so what makes libraries not only important but part of that, those digital changes and the technological changes, not sort of here in spite of them?
Well, it's a whole bunch of different things. But for me, and sort of where I work in Vermont, like one of the biggest things is saying everything's on the internet is great if you know how to use the internet. People who say it's all on Google probably haven't spent a lot of time watching people try to find what they want on Google. It's challenging. There's a lot of syntax to know. You've got to know how to use a mouse. You've got to understand clicking. What's a tab? What happens when I do this, that, and the other? And there really isn't a social institution dedicated to helping you figure it out. And then that's just for digitally divided folks, but for sort of average folks who know how to use a computer, they still need to know how to be discerning about the information they get. Lots of information on the internet is trying to push you in a very specific direction. I mean, Google's the largest ad agency in the world. That's actually where their money comes from. No big deal, but it's useful to know that when you wonder why you're getting that result on the top. A lot of people don't understand that thing is an ad. And if we're a democracy, the important thing about a democracy is that you get to inform yourself the way you want to and learn the things for you to make the decisions that affect your life, not someone else telling you how to do that. And so libraries are neutral in this really interesting way and not neutral in this other interesting way, in that they really want to help you be you, not you be what somebody else wants you to be.
Why? Do they have access to things that I can't get just by Googling?
Yeah. And we call these information silos and we sort of fight to knock them down in the library world. But you can get access to history books as an example. One of the examples I use a lot is like try to find an obituary for somebody who died in the late 70s, early 80s. It's really hard. It may be locked up in a newspaper archive and the newspaper maybe would like you to pay a couple bucks for it. Again, no big deal. That's their business. But the library can help you find that. Consumer Reports, for example. My public library subscribes to Consumer Reports. If you want to figure out how to buy a vacuum cleaner, you can come there and get access to that thing that otherwise you not only have to buy, but buy something that was published 8 months ago. And it's confusing and challenging. But the library just has it. And the person who works at the library is the person who can tell you how to get it. And that's why it's sort of people plus data, not one or the other.
Or for me, it's been trying to find information about, for example, diseases or medical issues when you want to go straight to the studies, not to the filter of some doctor who works for such and such website.
Or even a website like WebMD who gets a lot of money from Pfizer. Again, not a big deal, but the average person who types in, hypoglycemia is going to find results from places that sell you hypoglycemia medicine. Once you know that, you can make discerning choices. Maybe you need hypoglycemia medicine and that solves a problem for you. But you should be able to know, like, the National Institute of Health and PubMed are going to give you one set of results, especially original research, which for people who really want to get to the source is important. You know, WebMD is going to give you a different kind of thing. The Mayo Clinic's website is going to help you do this, that, and the other. And the forums are going to help you, you know, go hide under your bed because you're sure whatever you have is going to kill you. And being able to make those decisions is things a lot of people could use help with.
We're talking about the value of libraries in the digital age with Jessamyn West, and we're learning more about why she says if you care about democracy, you should care about libraries. If you have a question for her, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Anthony calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Anthony. Go right ahead.
Hi, I think this is a fantastic topic, and I'm calling to lament the closure of the physical space that used to be the Vermont Law Library in Montpelier, Vermont. It was a great library that had very helpful librarians, and in this age where there are so many people in the having to interface with the criminal and civil justice system without attorneys, it was a great resource for them, and even for people who are working with smaller law firms that don't have the money to subscribe to a lot of the proprietary databases where a lot of legal information is kept these days. It was just a tremendous resource to keep access to justice barriers lower. And so I think it's great you're focusing on this, and I can't say enough about how useful actual physical libraries can be, and the internet is just not a good substitute.
Anthony, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Jessamyn, what about this fact that we do see libraries closing for lack of support and funding?
Well, and Anthony raises a really good point, which is that one of the other things libraries offer is people who need information for, you know, life-changing issues. Like, I have a legal issue and maybe I can't afford a lawyer, and the state law library used to be a place in Montpelier you could go and get access to tools and resources that you wouldn't have otherwise. There have been terrible, terrible funding cuts to the State Department of Libraries. Just awful. We're one of the few states in – one of eight states in the country that doesn't have state-level funding that goes down to our public libraries. And so the state has been getting – more and more budget cuts, and they actually had to kind of – sort of complicated, but the Vermont Law School basically is where people can go to get access to legal information and legal help, but that's in South Royalton. That's not in Montpelier. There's no public transportation there. There's not the same crew of people to help you, and – you know, I believe it's sort of a short-sighted decision because what it is it's impacting negatively the very same people that those libraries are designed to help in the first place. And they don't – again, they don't do it on purpose. Like, money is real and you have to make the decisions you make. But it is really challenging to decentralize those. And every time you put something on the internet, you're basically keeping it away from somebody for whom the internet is not real yet.
Which is so interesting because you also – I know you're an advocate for open source stuff and open resources and this idea that the internet isn't always open even to people who have access to the internet. And so if you're putting things on the internet in other ways, you are getting people more access to things that they might not otherwise have been able to find if, for example, they were only in that law library.
Well, it's tricky, right? You have to do both. And for a lot of people, they hear both and they're like, you know, more expensive. But, you know, I'm a person who bought my health care on the exchange. And the Vermont healthcare website where you bought healthcare was challenging to use. Not an awesome website. There were lots of problems. But the people on the phone were amazing. They had the patience of saints. They were incredibly kind. And, you know, we only had 40,000 people signing up. It's almost hard to – I mean, I understand the economies of scale, which is why you would want to create these tools. But in many cases, the human touch to help people figure things out, a lot of what they were just doing was figuring out the website for people who really couldn't understand it because it wasn't very intuitive. And so any good plan to digitize information and make it more available has to have a human element to help the people for whom maybe your stuff doesn't work. There's no such thing as an absolutely intuitive interface, which is sort of my message to people who have a hard time with technology. Like, it's not you if it's hard to use. Somebody probably built it a little wrong, or maybe you're not their target demo. And it's useful to understand that as you struggle with technology, that there probably is a way you could learn to use it better, and there's a person who can help you.
We got a note from Owen and Margaret who say, we're new to Vermont, moving here just under 2 years ago. We love our new lives here, but we've been disappointed in the libraries. We live in a very small town. We love the small library here, but its resources are limited for obvious reasons. There's an interlibrary loan, but interlibrary loan is also a burden for the library. We wonder why Vermont doesn't follow a model found in other states, a state library card, which means that a citizen of the state can use any library. One other suggestion, we moved from Iowa, where if we presented documentation that we were Iowa residents at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, we were given a library card with borrowing privileges. Why can't we do the same at UVM? All state residents should be able to use this library.
Well, it's tricky. You can't do it at the University of Vermont, but you can do it in the Community College of Vermont system. So I live in Vermont. We have Vermont Technical College, which is a really fantastic library up on the hill in Randolph Center. And it's open late at night. It's got lots of technology. It's got free Wi-Fi. It's got a great lending library. And anybody who's a state resident can get access to that. And that's true for the entire community college system. UVM doesn't do it because of resources. And I do have to say, Iowa does have one of the better state library systems in the country. So again, we have a hard time with funding, and there have been priorities and choices. The Vermont Library Association and the Green Mountain Library Consortium are actually really trying and working towards a state card. Chittenden County now has a county-wide card that you can use at multiple libraries, but it may be that there's a small town near you that you can get a library card at for free. Some libraries have cards for free, some do not, that may fill in some of the gaps in your current library system.
We also have a note from Tom who says, the Burlington School District is planning on cutting library and media services by 50% next year. What effects will this have on students' literary skills, especially for English language learners?
Well, one of the things that we found, and there's data to support it, is that students do better in schools with school library media specialists or librarians. And places make decisions because they feel like, well, we can't cut math because you need that for the test, and you can't cut English because you need that for the test. But I do feel like for literacy, both English fluency and computer literacy, libraries are really one of the places that people can get unstructured access, which enables them to structure their learning in the way that's necessary for them, and getting some of those computer literacy skills. And the big deal is for a lot, again, digitally divided kids, that's where they do their homework, because maybe they don't have a computer at home, or they maybe don't have internet at home. And any cuts that you make to that system are really negatively impacting the people who are already having a hard time. So I think that's very frustrating. And I keep telling people, talk to their school boards, that that's not where these things should be happening. Again, I sympathize with the people who have to make those choices, but I think it's a short-sighted one.
If you could recreate or sort of wipe our brains and recreate a definition of what a library is or what a librarian is, how would you define it? Because, I mean, so many of us have these either images from our childhoods about a library or a librarian, or, you know, a definition that's sort of been handed across generations that's different in some ways from what libraries are today. How would you, I mean, just create the definition. What's a library?
Well, the big change is the libraries are for books. I think most of us have seen that changing in our lifetime, that a library is a community space. it's for, it's owned by the community in addition to being for the community. I think the big shift we're seeing now is the geographic focus of libraries is broadening, that in some ways the way you have a farmer's market and you can get local food, your library hasn't always been for local books. But as more information becomes available globally, the internet, giant databases that anybody can have, libraries are almost refocusing on helping the community sort of – I think of them as sort of a place where the community gets to show itself to itself or look at itself. And the librarians are not just the people who are being the information gatekeepers, as we used to say, and being like, well, don't really touch that book because it's fancy and you're not. But instead, hey, what do you need? What information needs do you need to solve? Here's some resources always set up, and here's a person who can help you figure out what other resources you may need. And we're seeing libraries nationwide branching out into all sorts of things, book delivery via bicycle or the makerspace movement, which people have mixed feelings about, but it has really brought a different type of person into the library, or English as a second language, which is huge as America becomes significantly more diverse, both with language diversity and people from other countries. So the best libraries are meeting the communities where they are and helping them grow in ways that are effective, efficient, and make them happy, and basically using the community's own money to help the communities be better. And the librarians are the people who facilitate and steward those interactions in order to ensure that they happen and ensure that they can continue to happen, which is the real key in sort of the battlefield that we see nowadays.
We've even seen libraries play a role recently in the last year or two, you know, as cities found themselves in the midst of protests, you know, at Ferguson, Baltimore, after police killings and some protests that erupted there, we really saw the libraries be a place where people were holding classes when schools were canceled, or even reporters were going for the free Wi-Fi because there were a lot of places where internet connections were being shut down and places were being closed. And the libraries were these sort of open resources for people in a way that I guess shouldn't be surprising, but in some ways was for people that, okay, here's this resource. It's still a community resource and it's still open in the midst of all this.
Right. We may not have our power on, but we can have bicycles that charge your phones. I mean, librarians really rose to meet that challenge in ways that were impressive. Our speaker at the Vermont Library Conference last year was Scotty Bonner from Ferguson, and he really talked about, like, it's just what we do. We saw a problem, we saw a need, and we met it head on and handled it because it's our job, not because we're trying to be showboats or not because it brings us money, although it happened to for the Ferguson Library, but because this is our community and our community is hurting and we have resources and trust that people have instilled in us that we can now turn around and it's our time to shine. So Ferguson did some wonderful things with classes. The Queensboro Public Library after Hurricane Sandy, our keynote speaker Rebecca Aldrich did a thing about sustainability in libraries. They were on the beach doing story time for traumatized kids before the Red Cross got there. And it's just – it's a great photo op, but whatever. It's also just a really cool thing to be doing. Those people have jobs. Part of their job is helping the community in whatever way they needed. And what they needed after Hurricane Sandy, especially in sort of coastal regions, was healing. And they needed to come together and the kids needed something to do and they needed to charge their phones and they needed that kind of thing. And in Baltimore, they needed the library to say, hey, we're open for you and we're open for everybody because that's actually the community. It's easy to be like, well, those people aren't our people. They're not my people. These people aren't our people. They're not my people. And for people to grump, grump, grump. But one of the things I love about the library is they're like, this is the geographic designation and everyone in this umbrella belongs to us and we belong to them. Work it out. And we're seeing libraries being really effective at that. And it's very gratifying to me.
We're talking again today with Jessamine West. She's a librarian, a writer, a technologist. She writes about libraries, has a role in the national library discussion as well. She's been really involved in getting a new nominee for the Librarian of Congress. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about more questions you have. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or you can tweet us at Vermont Edition.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking with librarian and library ambassador Jessamine West. In library circles, she's a rock star, and she had a big hand in helping to choose the nominee to be the next librarian in Congress in Washington, something the Vermont Library Association recognized her for with a big award. We're looking at why and how libraries matter in this day and age. We'd love your input or your questions for Jessamine West. You can write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. You can tweet us at Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Jeffrey in Grand Isle who says, Jessamine, a case in point. I'm working from home here in Vermont on a PhD on Freud. My school is in Europe. I simply need access to Freud's work in German, which UVM has, but I'm not allowed access. Can you make any suggestions? Thanks.
This is one of those really tricky questions, right? That information is probably on the internet, and yet you don't necessarily know where it is. My suggestion is to see if your library, first off, as the most legit way, can go get it, but also maybe Googling a little bit about how people find documents on the internet when they can't get access to them through their own libraries. Super tricky, I understand, but it's definitely a thing that if not your librarian, then other librarians would know how to do.
All right. Or, you know, maybe you can get a grant and go to Germany. That's what I would be working for. Bruce is calling in from Essex. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. And Jasmine, I'm on the State Library Board, and I just want to say congratulations on your award and also say thank you for your inspirational attitude about libraries. There are a lot of stories over Vermont that people don't often hear, and this is an example of a good one to hear, and I really appreciate it. And for the listeners, we don't have much of a state library system. It's local control, bottoms-up libraries. But in the light of the budget cuts we saw in the State Department of Libraries, we're trying to figure out a way forward. And Jessamine, please weigh in the future if you want and give us some ideas. But we want to maintain, with the reduced staff we have, a real, I think, service to public libraries. So thanks and congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Jessamine, the award that you won from the Vermont Library Association was Library Advocate of the Year, which is not given out every year, though, as far as I can see. It's sort of a given out when a case merits it. And so by your understanding, what do you think got you that accolade?
Well, I think the big deal usually it's an award given to sort of government people. And this year or in the last year, I've been really active. I mean, I'm really into civics in general. I mean, librarians are in general, but I really, really am. I'm a justice of the peace in my town. I marry people. I sit on the board of civil authority. I do all that kind of stuff. But I've also gotten involved on a national level because the Librarian of Congress finally retired after 28 years, which was a huge deal in the library world. I mean, it's one of those Halley's Comet type of things, not quite so much. But that offered an opportunity for people who consider themselves library advocates and maybe library activists to spend a little bit of time agitating to try and get somebody in that role who would do the things that I say we, but like librarians want. I mean, obviously that person does a lot of different things, but running the biggest library in the world, my feeling was that person should be a librarian. And so I took my sort of role as general internet loudmouth and started talking to people about what would you like? What do you think is important? What do we need? A lot of people felt that the Library of Congress had gotten maybe a little stagnant over the last while. How do we shake that up? Many of us know people who work there who say morale's been bad. And so spending a lot of time having community conversations, making a little website, agitating with the right people, having some important phone calls, and continuing the conversation on and on and on until Carla Hayden got nominated a couple months ago. I mean, it was so ridiculous. Like we were all live tweeting her nomination hearing like a bunch of goofy fangirls and boys. But it's a huge deal in our profession, and it's probably the most important job we're going to see anybody get in maybe our lifetimes, although now the term limit's 10 years, so maybe it'll happen again 10 years from now. But I think that was the big thing for this award, in that being involved at a national level, Vermont's very local and very into local. And it's one of the reasons I live here. But there are things happening at the national stage that we need to, I believe, be really involved in. And so I just kind of jumped in with both feet. And I think that was where that came from.
And what's so great about Carla Hayden?
She's amazing. She, you were talking about Baltimore, right? When the Baltimore riots happened, she was right out in front sticking a "We're open for business" sign on the front door of the public library. And way back in the day when I was kind of a baby librarian in early 2000s, she took John Ashcroft to task because he was being a little grumpy about the Patriot Act and being like, "Where are our librarians? They're just being, you know, acting. They're in hysterics about the Patriot Act. We're not coming after your records. Nobody cares about you." And she was like, "Actually, that's not kind. And I think you and I should chit chat about what's going on, because we heard what you said to the National Restaurant Association and it wasn't cool." And they had a really nice conversation. And that actually was the beginning of some of the reforms to the USA Patriot Act about the involved gag order, so you couldn't tell people when the FBI had come in shaking up your library. And I think it was a combination of things, both sort of a level of class and decorum on her part, being like, "No, actually, librarians are actually important, and you should treat us with some respect, actually." And also just what it did for, you know, the tiny libraries who are afraid. You know, the FBI comes to your library. That's scary. Even if you agree with every single thing they're doing, it's still a scary thing. And to have them be like, "You can't talk to anybody about this besides your lawyer," scary. And maybe overreaching and not necessary. And so she, when she was president of the American Library Association, you know, stood up, called a meeting, handled it. And she's done a lot of – she's just generally been sort of a good egg in library circles. She helped the Baltimore library system get a lot more savvy with technology, ebooks and Wi-Fi and that kind of stuff. And personally, she's just a nice, warm, friendly person, which is, you know, a huge deal. You know, not – Billington wasn't warm and fuzzy, the previous Librarian of Congress. And you kind of got the feeling he was too fancy for you. And you kind of get the feeling that Dr. Hayden – could run a library for everybody in the country, not just her special people.
You know, you mentioned that she was active in sort of pushing back on some of the things that were in the USA Patriot Act, and you've been pretty active in that too, particularly in relation to the provision that allowed the FBI to search library records without a warrant and then said libraries can't tell the public or the people whose records may have been searched that they've been searched. And you printed out or created these signs and distributed them that say things that a library could actually say, things like the FBI has not been here. And then underneath at the bottom of the sign, it says, "Watch very closely for the removal of this sign."
Yeah, those are, I mean, they have sort of a term now that I didn't even know at the time. They're called a warrant canary. So you can say nobody's been here. And then you can take down the sign that says nobody's been here. And that exists in a quasi-legal gray area where you're not saying they've been here, but you're not saying they still haven't been there.
Right.
And so it's not it's a little bit more of a theater than I think it's effective in a specific thing. But we're seeing more and more big corporations. You know, Google has a page that says this is how many national security letters we've been served, because it's not a search warrant where you have to go through a judge and people can see it. It's a national security letter, which is weird and quasi and secret and whatnot. And I think a lot of people felt weird about that, especially in the library world where, like, our stuff is public. Our meetings are public. Our spaces are public. We are yours. And so having to keep this level of secrecy was sort of not cool. And so the warrant canary idea is a broader idea. And I just sort of brought it to bear on what I conceived of as this particular not awesome part, which actually isn't part of the Patriot Act anymore, that it was a lawsuit, the Library Connection in Connecticut. They sued. They won. Very exciting. I like to think me and my stuff was a very small part of that.
And I think the Vermont Library Association actually handed those signs out to libraries around the state.
The Intellectual Freedom Committee sent copies to every library in the state.
We got a tweet from Billsville House who says, "Jessamine has been a library rock star since way back in the Metafilter days. Thanks for sharing all your knowledge." And we got a tweet from Rick Scully who says, "Jessamine is awesome. Seriously, make sure you talk about Moss, please." And you say on your webpage bio that one of the things you're into is Moss. So you're going to have to tell us about that.
Everybody needs an offline hobby.
And yours is moss.
And mine is going out into the woods and collecting moss and building little moss terrariums in my house so that me, who travels a lot and doesn't have any pets or children, still has something I can nurture and take care of in my home.
And it's something that, you know, you're laughing about now with what looks like sort of a wry laugh, maybe a little bit of embarrassment, but clearly not embarrassing because you put it out there as something that you're really into.
Yeah. No, it's a thing. It's a thing I care about, but it's also useful to be able to be that XYZ person. Uh-huh. So I'm like that librarian, that lady who likes moss, that person who lives in Randolph, the computer lady, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's one of my things.
What else is next for you in terms of pushing libraries into the future and pushing the importance of libraries moving forward?
Well, I'm sort of broadening my reach a little bit. I'm teaching an online class for the University of Hawaii's Library School graduate program starting next week, and we're doing a Tools for Community Advocacy. So really what I would like is for there to be an awful lot more people doing the kinds of things that I'm doing. But a lot of people need the toolkits and they need to understand what that's made of and that it's a thing that they can do. We haven't always been out in front of issues like that in the library world, but I think we can be. And so spreading the word, doing that, in addition to teaching my HTML class at VTC, is sort of what I'm doing next. More educating and talking to more people about more things.
Jessamine West is an influential librarian, writer, and technologist. She lives in Randolph and does all the other things that she just mentioned, in addition to collecting moss, which I want to see the terrarium, so I'm going to go online and see if
mossarium.com.
Oh, my God. All right. Mossarium.com. Jessamine, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, the state Republican convention is this weekend. Delegates will be elected to go to the national convention in July. Next on Vermont Edition, we'll talk with two young Vermont Republicans who hope to be part of that delegation. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On Saturday, the Vermont Republican Party will elect their slate of delegates to represent the state at the National Convention in Cleveland this summer. Two of the hopefuls are far from grizzled political veterans. In fact, one of them is still not quite old enough to vote. Jace LeCaire is a 17-year-old senior at Colchester High School, and Samuel Ennis is from Bethel, Vermont. He just returned home from New Hampshire, where he was a freshman at St. Anselm College. I spoke with them yesterday about what made them want to serve as GOP delegates. Jace LeCaire said age actually has a lot to do with it.
Well, the average age at the convention 4 years ago in Tampa was about 65 years old. So I thought I'd be a nice voice for millennials at the convention because we didn't really have that 4 years ago.
Well, and 4 years ago you couldn't vote, right?
I couldn't, no.
So, but you were still paying attention?
Yeah, I was a little bit.
When you saw that 4 years ago, was that when you got this idea of, I want to do that?
I think I got it this summer when I met Rand Paul, and his principles and message of liberty really inspired me to get involved.
Sam, what about for you?
You know, I was looking at this race and I saw how unique it is and how we don't usually have a possibility of a contested convention. And so before we got to this point, we had a couple more candidates in the race. I thought, wow, going to convention, I have the opportunity to make a real difference and be part of a very historical race. And I think so a lot of that reason is kind of why I decided to run as a delegate. I initially was thinking, I was trying to see kind of where the direction of campaign was going to go in terms of who was going to be the nominee. But I looked at it more and more, and I was like, wow, this is getting crazy in terms of the divide in the party. And I was just wondering, wow, I could really kind of help here.
Well, what are you thinking now that it's less likely that it's going to be much of a contested anything?
I still think it's a great opportunity to go. I think there's a lot that can be learned from it, kind of experience how it all works. And then a lot of what Jace was saying, kind of just provide a young voice of the party. I think that's kind of a huge thing here. There's, like you said, the average age is quite high compared to the young people in the state. And I think it's kind of a message to show kind of how active the young people are in the future of the party.
Well, for both of you then, how much of a voice do you anticipate having should you be elected and get to go? I mean, Jace, for you saying, you know, we need to have a voice in the party, we need to have a voice at the convention, how will you make sure that your voice is expressed?
Well, there is 16 delegates from Vermont, so one out of 16 is quite a big voice there, and there's only 2,400 nationally. So one person out of 2,400 can make a big difference, even especially if they're noticing you because you're so young.
And do you have things that you want to get across?
Yes, I would like to see a more libertarian, liberty, freedom-oriented platform than the establishment has in place right now.
So what do you anticipate doing to try to move the party in that direction?
Well, we elect pro-liberty people to the platform committee and try to make changes to the platform to be voted on at the convention.
And Sam, for you, what do you expect to be able to do?
Well, I'm hoping to, one, show how large in numbers the young voice is in the Republican Party, but two, in terms of accomplishments, you know, I feel like a lot of the young people today find themselves somewhere in the middle in terms of political party, whether they identify with one or not, or they lean left or they lean right. And so for me, I lean to the right side, and I find myself more as a moderate Republican. And so I feel like kind of those views, or maybe more classic Republican views, might get put out by some of the young people today. Or if you actually kind of take time and explain kind of things about the party, people might understand kind of where you're coming from and might more be in line with your views than they actually thought. So I think that's kind of more identifying and helping people understand the difference between the parties and what they actually stand for.
So do you both have a personal – I mean, now we know that the projected nominee is Donald Trump. So are either of you Donald Trump supporters in your personal life?
Well, I always just said that I would support the nominee. I suppose I'll probably be doing that quite reluctantly now, but nevertheless, I suppose.
So, Jace, you are, by virtue of your position, but also by virtue of what you stand for, you will support Donald Trump.
Well, I think if a libertarian nominee can get in the debates, get at 15%, that I could consider voting for a libertarian. But as it sits right now, yes, I'd vote for Donald Trump.
And Sam, for you?
So for me, early on, I was a John Kasich supporter, and because of his record of accomplishment and his long line of success and be able to get things done is kind of why I supported him. And since now seeing Donald Trump, I still can't bring myself to the point of being able to support him. Now, obviously, if I'm elected a delegate, I will vote either however they have me, vote either as part of the 8 for Kasich or the 8 for Trump. But personally, I have a hard time believing in Donald Trump because of his record of not being nice to various genders or religions. Or, you know, it's tough to kind of view that and see someone who's tends to be quite offensive and kind of find it hard to elect him as someone to represent our country.
Well, I'm curious then for both of you how you think about this, because clearly you're both passionate about politics and passionate about the Republican Party and trying to move it in the direction that you think it should be moving. And so for both of you, feeling like this is a candidate who you don't support personally, you know, how does that affect your decision to still think, well, this is a process that I still want to be a part of and still sort of be a part of that political machinery in the way that it works?
Well, I think by being a delegate at the convention, we can sort of shape the type of Donald Trump presidency and campaign that we want him to have. So
how?
Well, there's the platform committee, which adopts the platform that can, you know, all of Republicans and I guess Trump would have to abide by. And just by being there and having, you know, the voice and meeting the different people that will be involved with his campaign.
You think he will abide by it?
Well, he doesn't abide by a lot of it now, but I'm not quite sure.
Sam?
Yeah, I think the hope is through the committees we can kind of establish what the party is looking for in terms of unity. I think that's the huge issue here, is that even with him being the only candidate in the race, a lot of people are divided in terms of who they want to support. So I think the goal of the convention really is to try to get ideas from all sides of the party and contribute them to establish a platform to try to make him more attractive to all Republicans. I know a lot of people are finding a hard time, like I said, and even myself, supporting him, and I think that's going to create a large problem for the Republican Party. So kind of establishing a platform that might be more appealable to everybody. Now, that would involve a lot of commitment from Mr. Trump in terms of him having to honor these pledges and everything. So it's kind of on both ends to kind of figure this out.
So, Sam, you're in college out of state, but you're from Vermont, right?
Yes.
When you're home, at least, and maybe also at college, you know, how do you sort of represent yourself as a young Republican, and why is it important to you to be a voice for young Republicans in both in Vermont and outside of Vermont for you?
Yes. Yeah, so in Vermont, I was just recently elected chair of my town Republican committee. And so I think I've attended a few meetings so far, and I'm seeing kind of how everything's set up. So understanding how the layout works in Vermont and everything. So I'm kind of new to this and kind of learning about it as I go. And so I'm seeing kind of how everybody's working together, how we're supporting local candidates and various things like that. So that's kind of my involvement here and then running for delegate. In New Hampshire, I've been active with working on a political campaign. I've seen about from the time Scott Walker exited every presidential candidate other than Hillary Clinton, and that was just because I wasn't in class. I've gone to many of the GOP meetings over there, so I've been able to kind of see and be active and kind of see how the Republican Party works, specifically in New England, because it is a little different than other places. And I think through all that's kind of shown my involvement, and it's through all that that I've really kind of found I do love politics, and it is something I like studying everything, but I've been able to, through being involved both in New Hampshire and here, I've really gained a lot of experience.
Do you get pushback from your peers who say, wait a minute, first of all, Vermont is so liberal, and young people tend to be more liberal than old people, and here you are, a Vermont Republican?
Yeah, so I think a lot of what I find that is, you know, and I talk to my friends here, and I think a lot of them understand actually where I'm coming from. They're slowly starting to see what I'm talking about and kind of seeing what I'm saying and the truth in what I'm saying. In New Hampshire, one of the common things I see, like with my friends and stuff, they're like, oh, you're from Vermont, and the fact that I'm Republican shocks many of them. And talking to speakers that have come to the college, they've found that interesting as well. And I said, well, you know, it's sometimes difficult, but I believe in what I believe in, and I believe that in order for Vermont as a state in itself just to be successful, that it needs to get more move towards Republican values. And I think a lot of that can help with the economic issues the state has been facing in a lot of areas like that.
And Jace, you're still in high school. What do you find in terms of interactions with your peers on politics?
Well, I think it would surprise you. Maybe it's just the town I'm from, but there are a lot more young people getting involved with the Republican Party. But we do still face some criticism from the students, but also the teachers a lot with, you know, it's not a hidden fact that most teachers and professors are liberals, and we do get some pushback from them trying to silence us. But with the students, I think it's mostly good discourse back and forth.
What are the teachers doing that when they try to silence you?
Well, political correctness, for one. They just try to, you know, you say something about traditional marriage or something like that, they'll label you a bigot and they won't allow you to talk about it. Or, you know, abortion, they'll throw their two cents in. And then if you try to rebuttal with a pro-life argument, they won't really be having it and try to, you know, they'll silence you.
So you feel like your views are being silenced because of your politics in high school?
Yeah, I mean, my school, Colchester High School, I mean, the teachers are pretty good there, but I hear horror stories from other schools across the state and colleges about how their professors are just, you know, completely out of line.
How does that affect you when you think about your future and your future in politics?
Yeah, well, I do plan to go to college in Vermont, so I'm wondering how it would all, you know, kind of work out. But, you know, you just have to keep fighting for the values that you believe in, even though you might try to be silenced by some.
What are your career goals?
Well, I plan to major in computer science and minor in politics. So politics is definitely something I want to keep with throughout my life.
And would you ever go into elected politics?
Yeah, I would be very open to running for public office. Maybe start with a state rep thing and move up from there.
Sam, for you, is politics in your future?
Yes, my major at St. Anselm College is politics and history. And I think through that, through this race, I've confirmed that that is definitely where I like exploring. And in terms of career, I would definitely entertain the ability to run for public office. I think I enjoy the ability to represent people and kind of help solve their issues and help them understand government and help government in its limited sense at the state level, and to work for them and be able to help with issues we may face.
Well, I look forward then to seeing both of your names on ballots in the future, and I really appreciate you both talking to me, and good luck this weekend. Sam and Jace, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jace LeCair is a senior at Colchester High School. Sam Ennis lives in Bethel and goes to St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. They're both hoping to be elected to represent Vermont's Republican Party at the National Convention in July. Both parties, Vermont Republicans and the Democrats, are meeting for their respective state conventions this weekend. And we will have much more on that tomorrow when we hear what goes on at these conventions, how delegates are chosen, and how the party platforms are put together. It's a confusing process, so if you have a question about that, send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net and we'll try to get it answered on tomorrow's show. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.